Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. Your host today is Katrine, and I'm excited to be here with Jeremy Zirsi, and he is willing to be our victim today and talk with all of us about his past in Mormonism. So, Jeremy, thanks for coming.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
Were you born into the church?
I was indeed. I was born in the church. I was born in Salt Lake City, actually, and then when I was about six, we moved to St. George, Utah, and then we moved a lot when I was young. My dad wasn't in the military or anything, but we just moved a lot. I think it had a lot to do with just money. We didn't have a lot of money. And so we were always trying to find a place where we could call our own. So we moved all over in St. George. And then finally, I think because of money as well, we traveled all the way to Texas when I was about 14 or so, and to live with my mom's sister and her family. She's a twin. My mom's a twin. So they're really close and they let us come in, but they had a lot of kids too. So there's my family. I have two brothers and two sisters. So, you know, there's seven of us, and then, their family have like eight. And so we were all crammed into this house there. And that was kind of a wild ride. We didn't have a great experience in Texas.
Yeah. That's like 16 people, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They had a fairly good house, but I mean, it was fairly big, but we were still crammed in there, and it wasn't our place until we were finally able to find a place. I mean, we were there for quite some time, but then we finally found, an apartment, and Texas was interesting. As the church is different there, as anyone who doesn't live in Utah is aware. It was different there. I had always been really, I hadn't questioned the church like at all, ever, like for most of my life. And so as I grew up in the church, you know, there wasn't any question, but I always just wanted to be as good a person as I could possibly be. And I really stressed out about as being as good a person as I could possibly be. And I was always worried that I wasn't either trying hard enough or I wasn't doing enough. But, you know, when I was in the church, you know, I was always like assigned as the deacon's quorum president or the, you know, the first assistant or whatever they call the priest one as
the
I went
counselors.
Up.
Or no?
Well, in the priest quorum, they don't have a president because the bishop's the president.
Oh,
and
okay.
So whatever they call that.
I don't know. Thing. I was a woman.
Yeah, I know. You guys don't know about the secret dealings of
yes.
the priesthood. So yeah, anyway. So, you know, and, you know, I was in scouts. And so like I would be the leader there. But I always stressed about, you know, doing a good job and making sure I was doing everything. And when I was young is when I first started, because I worried so much and I had so much anxiety about things, I had my very first panic attack when I was, goodness, I must have been 10 years old, really young. I remember, I was laying in bed, and for some reason I started thinking about, eternity, and my mind kind of went down this crazy, this crazy hole of just thinking about how long eternity was, and it really freaked me out. And then because of that, I remember jumping up out of my bed and just running to my parents' room, and just with complete panic on my face, and just, you know, I freaked them out because they didn't know what was going on. And I don't remember what I told them, but I basically that I was scared or whatever. And, you know, and they, you know, they calmed me down. But from that point on, it was a fairly regular occurrence for me to have panic attacks. I always had to have something like a book or something nearby me so that I could distract myself if my mind shifted towards anything that was a trigger for me. And for me, it started with infinity was just this weird trigger for me. And then it kind of morphed into being, you know, open spaces. Were kind of triggering, especially if there were no clouds, if there were cloud cover, but just like the open blue sky, I guess it's sort of representative of infinity in my brain or whatever, but I had a really hard time dealing with, you know, open spaces. And so I remember sitting in class one day, and it was the last day of school. And so we didn't have our textbooks with us, and I had to sit there And I realized I don't have anything to distract me and I can't stand up, and I could feel the panic start to swell. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't move because that would be weird. And we were just kind of sitting there. And so I started just doing math problems, just writing with my finger on my desk, doing math problems to distract myself from it. And that started to be a thing that I would try to do, just try to do. It's not like I'm wonderful at math, but it was just a way to get my mind occupied with something else. That continued for most of my life up to this point. Yeah.
That was pretty young. When you got older, did you start to realize what was happening?
Yes. I don't remember when I first, it might have even been my mom that put the name panic attack to it. But I can't remember exactly when that was. I might have been a little bit older though. But it doesn't, knowing what it is, it doesn't help.
Yeah.
You know? So I had them really bad there until I was, I don't know, maybe teenager, 16, 17 years old. And then I would still have them occasionally, but they kind of tapered off. As I started getting closer to my mission age, I started getting, you know, kind of anxious again, because that's kind of a big decision. And I was worried about, you know, because I wanted to do a good job. I just wanted to do a good job. And I had it in my mind that if I didn't do everything right when I was on my mission, that it would be my fault if somebody didn't accept the gospel. So that's crazy making, you know, because it's just, you don't have control over anybody else. But I had in my mind that I really needed to be in control enough to be able to make sure that I did everything that I possibly could, because I knew there's a scripture in the Book of Mormon that if we didn't, you know, if we don't work as hard as we possibly can, that their blood will come upon us. You know, and so I took that to heart, and I knew that if I didn't work as hard as I possibly could, and if I didn't do everything right, that it would be my fault.
Well, how many mission stories have we heard where they say they went to the very last door, they were tired, but they decided just one more door, and that was their golden family, and they brought a family of 12 into the church, and
yeah,
if they hadn't gone to that last door, it could be stressful, at the very least.
Yeah, it was. You know, so I had that in my mind. And the funny thing is, as I was thinking back on this, preparing for my mission, I remember I was driving my car in the car with my dad at one time. And I think I was 18 at this point. So it was getting kind of close. And I said something to the effect, because I was thinking about it as like, everybody just expects that I'm going to go on a mission. And I think that kind of came out of left field. And my dad, I think that was true, but my dad was great about the fact that he said, it is up to you if you go. It was still kind of expected, but he didn't say, well, of course you have to go. And so he said the exact right thing that I felt when I was like, well, I guess I'll be going. So it wasn't, if he had pushed me at that point, I don't know what would have happened, but he kind of backed off. And so I was able to, you know, my own anxiety and my own desire to be, you know, the best Mormon I could be was enough to push me. I look back on it, and I think that's the very first time that I can think of in my life where I started to question just my path in the church and what I was, you know, what I was going to end up being, the kind of person I was going to end up being in the church. And, so I went to Puerto Rico on my mission. And when I got to the MTC, it was not great I feel really, really bad for my companions, at least my first few companions on my mission, but specifically the companion I had in the MTC, because I was wound so tight and I was so afraid of doing something wrong and screwing something up and like either ruining my mission or just because if I'm bad, then I won't have the spirit. And if I don't have the spirit, then I can't teach the people. And if I don't teach the people, then they won't be able to go return to Heavenly Father. And if they don't return to Heavenly Father, then it's all my fault, you know, and that's just constantly playing over and over in my head. And so the mission president of the MTC, I remember him talking about how, you know, you need to be super obedient. You need to be extra obedient, you know, and that if that means, you know, if the wake up time is 6:30, then make sure that you're waking up at, you know, it's 6:29, so that, because if you're breaking the rules even a little bit, then you know, you're not being obedient. And so, you know, that was, I was a perfect person to tell that to. So that just like, okay, yeah. So now I started waking up at 6:26 and make sure that I was up in plenty of time and, you know, reading the scriptures. And then I was in the classes at the MTC and it was the first, and I can't believe this is actually true, but it was the first time that I had heard of any, that I remember hearing about the apostasy or about, I don't actually know what my understanding of the church was at the time, even though I went every single Sunday and I, even if my parents didn't go or someone didn't go, I would go to church. But for some reason, the teachings of the church didn't sink in really great. And I hadn't read the Book of Mormon all the way through. And I realized as I was there that I don't think I have a testimony of the church. I really don't think I do. And so that kind of heaped on top of the other anxiety that I was already feeling about I have to be as good as possible. And then suddenly I'm feeling in my mind, it wasn't the fact that it might not be true. It was the fact that I hadn't done the work necessary to be able to know that it was true.
So it was all your fault.
So it was all my fault. Yeah. You know, there's a recurring theme in my life that, you know, a lot of the stuff that is going on, it's my fault. Since I was going to Puerto Rico, that's why I had to learn Spanish. And so, you know, I had the Spanish language things and that was difficult. You know, learning a new language is difficult. And so I had that on top. And then, you know, my companion and the other elders around me just didn't. They just didn't like me very much. And I don't blame them, really.
Is that because you were wound so tight?
Because I was wound so tight. Not because, you know, because before, you know, not to toot my own horn, but before the, I'm going to toot anyway. Before I went on the mission, I had friends and people thought I was funny and, you know, and I didn't have a hard time interacting with other people. But as soon as I went on there, it just all clamped down. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there was even one day, it was a Sunday, but my companion wanted to buy stamps from one of those automated stamp machines, and I wouldn't let him do it because that was breaking the Sabbath, and that made him so mad, and that would have made me mad too if I was looking back on it. I just cringe at a lot of those things. So because of all of that, I really wanted, you know, I buckled down and I was like, okay, I'm going to read the Book of Mormon, but I didn't want to start from the beginning because I'd started from the beginning so many times. So I started from Mosiah and I'm like, okay, I'll read through. I start from Mosiah and I started reading through and, you know, I didn't finish by the time I got out to the mission field. It just wasn't enough time. But, you know, I got out there and I still didn't really have a testimony and I still didn't really.
Did you recognize that you didn't have a testimony, or did you just think that it was hard?
It was, yeah, I knew I didn't have a testimony and it was hard.
Okay.
You know, the first day we arrived there, we got there and there, some elders met us there at the mission home, and then a couple of them grabbed us and they took us out tracting, like immediately. We hadn't even like put our, our bags away or anything. It was like that night.
Wow.
And
well, you had to get to that door. Yeah,
I know, seriously. And we tracked it out this house and they let us in. And holy crap, I was so nervous. You know, I back then we had the missionary discussions, and so I had the missionary discussion just plopped down in front of me, and I started, you know, we had to take turns, so the guy I was with would talk. And I kind of understood what he was saying, but then they might say something. I had no idea what they were saying. And then it would come to me and I would just read it, just staring down at it, just feeling so overwhelmed and just so inadequate that I just didn't know what I was doing. And I was scared to death that I was ruining these people that could be potential members of the church. And I was ruining them because I wasn't doing a good job. Yeah, so I don't know what happened with those people, but hopefully they just went on their merry way and it was fine. But, and then my first companion had, he didn't know what to do with me because I was wound so tight. But I will say as time went on in my mission, I did start to relax, and it wasn't anxiety as much as kind of a depression would kind of settled over me because I had some success, but I never felt like I was, you know, doing enough. And because it was, you know, it's hot. in Puerto Rico. And it's the middle of the day and people are, you walk up to their door and you well, in Puerto Rico, you actually call from the road and they can either come out to you or not.
Oh, I wish they had that here.
I know. Wouldn't that be, so they weren't right there in front of you. Yeah. Just, you go out from the gate and just, Buenas tardes, and just yell at the door and they either come out and say we're Catholic or they come out and just say we're not interested. And then you move on to the next one. And just door after door in 100 degree weather with 80% humidity. And it just.
With depression, that has to be incredibly taxing.
Yeah. It was really taxing. And I didn't know. Well, I just kept muscling on trying to do the best I could. I finally was able to, and I think it was my first area, I was able to finish reading the Book of Mormon, and you know, I was done. I was like, okay, I can pray about it. And so, you know, I prayed about it and I didn't feel anything. Strangely enough, I didn't feel anything, but I was like, well, you know, maybe it just takes time. Cause you know, they say, sometimes they tell you, you know, you're not going to get like, I wasn't expecting an angel or anything, but I was hoping for something. Mm-hmm. You know, but there was nothing. What it kind of morphed into was that over time, I had enough good experiences with like either talking to people or somebody would give like a good talk during a meeting or something and I would feel good. And I kind of took all of those cumulative feelings together and said, okay, well, I guess I've kind of always known that it's true, right? I didn't ever receive a, you know, I feel good about it when I read. You know, I feel good inside, so I think that's enough, right? Yeah. So I therefore, I know the church is true. And I always said, whether I knew or not, you know, when you're talking as a missionary, you tell, I know the church is true. I know it's true. I know Joseph Smith was a prophet. I know the church is true. I know the Book of Mormon's true, and it's the Word of God. And you say that over and over again, and, you know, you believe it after a while.
Yeah, so, I did the same thing, and I'd even think, well, I don't feel bad about it. So.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, I spiked the sound there, but,
you're fine.
Yeah. But yeah, it's okay. That was exactly it though. I don't feel bad about it. I feel okay. I feel good, I guess. So it must be true. And it was the only thing I'd ever known. And so, what else can there be?
Plus you're on a mission.
Yeah.
Well, it'd be hard to change your mind at this point.
Exactly. I mean, just imagine all the people I'd be disappointing and imagine, you know, so wound so tight anyway, you know, I don't want to disappoint anybody. And, you know, so I made it all the way through my mission.
Did it get easier towards the end?
Towards the very end? Yeah. I had some pretty rough patches, in the middle that at one point I was just so down and so depressed that, the mission president had to drive a couple hours out to us and sit down and talk to me because, you know, my companion didn't know what to do, and he just said, call the mission president. And so the mission president was a great guy, and he came down, and it was interesting because I had been doing a pretty good job, you know, working as hard as I could, even though I still always felt that I could do better. I had been working as hard as I could, and yet I still felt terrible. And so I asked him, and I said, why do I feel so bad if I'm doing, you know, the right things? And he explained it as we wind closer to God, there are times where he will remove his presence from us to see if we'll stay faithful.
That's kind of mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. I know. I was like, well, that's kind of a jerky thing to do, but I guess he's God, so he knows what he's doing, right? And who am I to question what God does? And so that kind of made sense. In a way.
Well, and it's kind of a promise that he'll come back to you if you just stay strong.
Oh yeah.
He'll return.
And to be fair, I didn't stay depressed, you know, and I was fine after that. I had, you know, I loved, you know, a lot of my companions. The best part of the mission was hanging out with the other elders. Well, it was mostly elders. I wish we'd had more sisters, honestly, there, but we only had a few and I didn't get to interact with them very often, but I made it through the mission. And at the very end, the last conversation with the mission president, I went into it and I felt terrible because I felt like I had failed on my mission because we'd had a few baptisms, but they were not a lot, and I should have worked harder. I should have done better. And so I was crying. And
were you getting outside pressure, like from the mission president, or was this all internal?
No, it was all internal.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you have a general feeling of what you should be doing and how hard you should be working just from everybody else. But I mean, I was definitely not the worst missionary out there. It was 99% internal that I didn't feel like I was doing a good job. And during that interview, he gave me a blessing, and I felt wonderful after that. You know, I felt the strongest. The only way I can describe it is the strongest spiritual experience that I'd had up to that point. And I felt at peace, and I felt good. And I felt that was good. I did do an okay job because he said so in the blessing, you know, and I felt great because I look back on it now, and it was because the responsibility, he was able to, whatever he said in that blessing, he was able to remove the responsibility off of me. And I felt like God was happy with what I'd done, and that he wasn't angry at me for not having done a good job. And so because I was able to stop blaming myself, I was just, it was huge relief, and it was good. And that was, that experience right there is the experience that I carry for most of my adult life for thinking of why I should believe in the church. It was that experience that was really it. Yeah. So after the mission, my wife had waited for me, my whole mission, and we broke up for 2 days after I got back, and then we got back together, and then we got married 3 months later.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, right?
It was one of those rare missionary stories.
I know.
Worked.
She, well, I always put quotes around the fact that she waited. I mean, she dated other guys, you know, while I was gone, but she wrote me every week while I was there, but she was still dating other guys, and it was fine, but you know.
Yeah, as it should be.
As it should be. It's not like, you know, well, in my mind, she should have been.
Well,
not well, even that. Yeah, it was like, how could you possibly want to date anybody else but me? But yeah, so we got married in the Salt Lake Temple. Yeah, the temple, my first temple experience.
Yeah, let's go back to that.
Yeah, I went to the temple prep classes. I went, you know, and talked to people as much as I could. And so I tried to get as prepared as I possibly could to go to the temple. And I had no idea, you know, what was there. So this is back in 97. And, so this was, you know, pre-internet stuff and time. And so I had no idea what was going on. And I remember going in there and then seeing the outfit on somebody, and it was so weird. So weird.
Did you know you'd be changing into clothes?
They gave me the bag, and yeah. I didn't really look at it. And then they do the thing beforehand, like the washing and anointing beforehand. And you know, and this was back before when you had to get completely naked underneath that, just that weird thing that you put over the top. And so that was weird. And then they gave me this packet, but I didn't really look at it. I saw a little bit of green in there, but you know, I didn't really open it up. And then I turned and I just saw this guy. He must have just gotten out of a session. And I turned and I looked, and he's just like, "That's so weird. What is that?" And
had you never seen temple clothes before?
No,
that?
No, really? Never. And you know, nobody died in my family.
Yeah.
Up until that point, which is crazy because we have a crazy big family, but no. My grandparents were, you know, all relatively young. And so no, I'd never seen anybody laid out and stuff. And I'd never seen my parents had never like shown me temple clothes. So I had absolutely no idea what it looked like or what was going on. And so, you know, but then I'm there, I'm inside the temple and, you know, and then they give you the names and that was later because you use your own for that, but then they have the other name that you have to remember. But you're not supposed to say. And so I was terrified that I was going to forget. And during the whole thing, I was just.
Was this an anxiety moment for you?
Yeah, it was anxious because it's just like in my mind, I was thinking, this is the temple. This is supposed to be awesome. This is awesome? Question mark. You know, as I'm looking and it's just so ritualistic, and that does not do it for me. Ritual, you know, for some people, I guess it does it for them, but mm-hmm. ritual has never been something. It just seems odd, and it just seems creepy. Honestly, you get used to it after a while. It's not like it was my last time I went to the temple, especially before my mission. You know, every single week I made sure that we were there because, you know, first of all, that was a rule, and I went in and made sure I was being good, and I wanted to be able to, remember all this stuff. But yeah, that's the temple was just, it was never a place for me that I felt. The only time I felt at peace was like when you're sitting in the chapel before you go in, because they're just playing music and it's just quiet and you can sit and think. And then afterwards, it's just quiet and you can sit and think. Those were the nice times. You didn't have to worry about it. The rest of it just stressed me out like crazy. Because, you know, I know the things. And it's like, okay, we got to this point, so we have this much we have left to do. Okay, we got to this point, and we have this much we have left to do. And it's just, you know, counting down the minutes until we can finally be done.
I kept panicking. I can't remember this. I don't remember this. How am I going to remember this?
I know. Oh, man. The thing at the end you're supposed to remember. I just repeated over and over and over and over in my head, which made it worse because I was so panicked that I was going to forget that I would make myself forget. Yeah. Anyway. So that was my great temple experiences. And yeah. So we've been married a few years, and one day I'm a software developer, and one day I was at work, and this just huge wave of nausea just fell over me, just like a guillotine, just slammed me hard. I'm just out of nowhere.
Was it different than a panic attack?
Yeah. Cause I'd never felt, nausea. I mean, I've been sick before and, I'd thrown up before, but just like it was out of nowhere. And so I had to have my wife come pick me up because I couldn't do anything. It just completely overwhelmed me. And then from that time on, till today, these panic attacks started getting stronger and more frequent and stronger and more frequent.
Was there a trigger for them?
Yeah. So at the beginning, it went back to, infinity and thinking about death. If I had any sort of thinking about death at all would immediately trigger it. And I would, so I had to work as hard as I could not to think about those things and to keep myself out of situations where that might happen, which would make it really awkward for like conference, like general conference or things like that, because it's always talking about the eternities and where we're going and things like that. And so I would have to do these mental gymnastics to keep myself stable in a place where I wasn't, actively panicking. So I started having to miss a lot of work. Then the trigger started being, I felt that trigger when I was at work. And so then the trigger was going to work.
That's a problem.
Yeah, that is a definite problem. And, I had sick days, but then those ran out. And then it's just like, I don't know what else I can do. And so I just had to kind of muscle through it as best I could. And I did okay, but I lost like 20 pounds just because I couldn't eat because I was just feeling sick all the time. And
up until this point, have you ever sought any kind of mental health help or anything?
No, never. So then finally, my wife is like, you got to go to the doctor, talk to him. And I finally did. And then they put me on Zoloft, and that seemed to help a little bit for a little while, and things evened off a little bit. I would still have the attacks every once in a while, but they kind of evened off a little bit. Another one of the triggers, because I couldn't think about death, but that also meant that I couldn't think about if I ever had any sort of a doubt about the church or anything like that, it would trigger as well, because I couldn't think about that sort of thing, and it would immediately just overwhelm me. And then it just nausea, and just for people that haven't experienced a panic attack, it can take different forms, but the worst is when you literally feel like you're going to go insane, because the world for me anyway, I suddenly feel disassociated with the world, and I feel like I'm not with myself. And my heart starts to pound, and the nausea slams down home, and I have to get out of the situation, whatever it takes. And so another trigger would be if I'm stuck somewhere where I can't get out. If I know, like if I'm in a car, especially if I was in a traffic jam or something like that, that would definitely be a trigger because I can't, there's nowhere I can go. I can't do anything. And so if I couldn't think about any doubts about the church, and I couldn't think about eternity, and I couldn't go out in all wide open spaces, and I couldn't, if I got stressed out of work, because work can be stressful, you know, that would be another trigger. And it was just building and building and building and building. And I remember one Memorial Day, and it's a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. My wife's family does a big thing where they go out to Graveside in Provo and you know, put flowers down on all ancestors and things like that. And it's actually a really fun trip, but I couldn't go because I was feeling sick because I was so stressed out. And so my wife took the kids and just kind of left me at home, but none of the things were working that would calm me down. You know, I tried watching something on TV and it wasn't distracting me enough. And I tried, you know, everything that I could possibly think of, and none of it was working. And so I finally just, I called my mom, you know, cause my wife was in Provo, you know, she was like 45 minutes away. And, you know, and I was just like, I was just with tears. I was just like, I don't know what to do. And so they came and got me, and they took me to the medical care, emergency medical care place. And they, I was waiting there for my turn, and I was freaking out, and I was feeling so sick, and I just wanted to die because it was so bad. It felt like it was something that was just never, the rest of my life was going to be like this. It was going to be small pockets of semi-sanity followed by just the rest of just insanity, insane nausea and panic. And so I was trying to keep myself calm, just fighting as hard as I could to keep the panic away. And then I finally got in there and I just collapsed on the table, said, you know, is there anything that you can do for me? Can you help me? And he finally said, yeah, there's, you know, we can give you a pill. And the fact that he said that there was something that he could give me that would immediately take it away, the panic all of a sudden just receded. And even before, you know, so he wrote me a prescription. I can't even remember what it was for.
Did he understand what was happening?
Yeah,
with you?
I think he knew it was a panic attack. So he gave me something for that. And it was, so it wasn't like one of the ones you take to keep the steady state. It was like a more powerful version. I can't remember what it was, but I went and got it. And finally, you know, the panic started to come back before I took it. But as I was waiting, they finally got it. I took it, and then I immediately felt better. Like I felt better before. It would make sense medically for it to feel better, but it's because I'd taken
placebo.
It was the placebo. No, it was totally placebo. And so I took the thing, and then whatever it was, it knocked me out. And then I was, you know, I fell asleep for a few hours. And so from that point, I got on medication again, but the medication stopped working because I was able to convince myself that it wasn't working. And so would get higher and higher doses, but it just wasn't doing anything to stop the panic. And I started contemplating, you know, I can't live like this anymore, you know? So I, not seriously, but started contemplating suicide. Is like, I can't deal with this for the rest of my life. And then it was like, oh no, I can't do that to my kids and my wife. And
were you verbalizing any of these feelings with anyone?
Not those ones specifically. That was internal. But I mean, my wife knew how upsetting this was because she could see how upset I was. But yeah, those specific, you know, thoughts of suicide, I didn't really share with anybody because, well, it's hard to share those thoughts with anybody when you're super anxious and super depressed at the same time. So finally, you know, since the medication wasn't working and, you know, nothing else was working, we went like on Amazon and we just like looked for books on anxiety. And I found a book called Don't Panic. What is it? By Reed Wilson. And amazing book, because specifically he is very good at actually, he obviously understands people, you know, anxiety disorder. And the main thing that I learned from that, and that I, it took practice over time, was that you had to be able to sit and feel panic.
That sounds like fun.
I know, right? So my entire life, and anybody with generalized anxiety disorder, they do this. They, you know, you start to avoid, you know, it's like, well, I felt panic in the library, so I can't go back to the library because, you know, it might trigger another one. So I can't go there, or maybe I can go to this part of the library, and then, but thinking about being in that part of the library reminds you of the other part of the library. So he's like, oh, I can't go to the library anymore. And then, you know, it's like, well, I can't go to the grocery store because I felt panic in the dairy aisle. And then your world starts to contract. And, you know, towards the end, before I got the book, I couldn't exercise, because exercising made my heart rate accelerate, which felt like a panic attack, which would trigger a panic attack. And so I couldn't mow the lawn because that was like exercise. And, you know, I couldn't, having people over, you know, stressed me out. So that would cause a panic attack. And so my world was just contracting. And because that's how the fear works, the only way to actually defeat it is to basically face it and accept it. And so what I had to do was I had to sit on the couch and I had to tell myself, okay, I'm starting to feel a panic attack. Oh, this is actually really terrifying. Every instinct in me is to shove it away, is to just get rid of it. Do whatever you can to stop, because I'm going to go insane, or my heart's going to stop, or I'm going to pass out. But you don't. You sit with it and you say, okay, this is terrifying. And I acknowledge that it's terrifying, but I'm going to sit here with it, and I'm just going to feel panic for a little while. And you do. And the amazing thing is that for me, almost immediately when I was able to start doing that, the panic would almost immediately just go away. So as soon as I was able to sit there and say to myself, you know, oh, I can feel the panic coming on. All right, bring it on. That came my really corny way to say, just bring the panic on. And so I would sit there and just bring it on, and I would just feel it, and then it would go away. And the next time I would sit there and I would just feel it, and it would be terrifying, and it would go away. And as I started to do that, they just stopped coming. Like, as often at all. You know, but it was like daily or even hourly for a while there, but it's just stopped. You know, I could go a week.
How long a time period do you think this was?
This, from when I was at the very worst to where I felt like I was pretty solidly over a lot of it, was maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Oh, not too long.
No, it wasn't. It actually was
except
surprising.
When you're full-blown panic.
Exactly.
Like forever.
It feels like an eternity. It stretches out really bad. But yeah, so it was, it didn't take terribly long. And if anybody has anxiety, panic attacks, I would really recommend that book. And it did wonders for me, and it really helped that, you know, it wasn't weirdly self-helpy. You know, it was just like, this is what's going on in your body. This is why it feels this way. And this is what you can do to work past it. And the amazing thing was it worked. And so it just completely changed me. And so once I was able to sit with panic and actually start to look at those things, it's when I was in the shower one morning and I was just thinking, and then I just started thinking about death, and just in general, which is a weird random thing to think in the shower, but I just started thinking about death. And I actually said for the first time, I think, ever was, you know, well, what if the church isn't true? And that caused panic almost immediately. But I'd had practice up to that point. And I was like, well, what if it isn't true? Then when I die, then that's just it. Which is an interesting, you know, it doesn't have to be that way, but, you know, you can, like, not be a Mormon and still believe in God and an afterlife and things. But in my mind, there was no, there's no difference between the church not being true and there not being any, I mean, none of the other religions make any lick of sense at all. You know, if Mormonism isn't true, what other one's going to be true? It just didn't make any sense in my mind. The basic part of that was I had to think back and just, well, do you think God really exists? And, you know, I had to let myself sit with that and think, well, what if he doesn't exist? And I started to think back on all, you know, all the times that I had felt like I had felt the spirit, you know, like the time on my mission, at the end of my mission where I had felt it. Or I remember really feeling it powerfully during the Book of Mormon talk by one of the general authorities that I cannot remember his name right now. The really popular one that did recently.
I don't know. There's lots of general authorities that give him Mormon talks.
What's his face? I always forget. Nah, I'm terrible with names. Anyway.
Is it Uchtdorf?
No, it's not Uchtdorf. It's, I won't remember. Anyway, like, cut this all out.
I'll splice it in later.
Yeah. But, you know, he gave a really strong talk on the Book of Mormon, and I remember that, and I felt really, you know, I felt really good about it. And I was able to actually think about it. It was just like, well, how is it the only evidence that I have that any of this is true is, you know, is internal. And it's in my brain, right? And there's no external way of, you know, by design, there's no external way to test God. Even if you give that the church is true, that God isn't, except for when he does, isn't going to come down in front of you and say, here I am, you know? And so.
So it sounds like you're kind of questioning God and religion and Mormonism, or are you just questioning the church?
Oh, both. Both. It was a simultaneous thing. Okay. It's like, well, if the church isn't true, then God definitely isn't there.
Oh, wow.
Was how my mind worked. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't go from, well, the church isn't true, but I'm sure there's a God out there. It's just, no.
That wasn't.
That just, how you it thought. Just, it all just went at the same time. It wasn't an extremely fast process because I had been the gospel doctor and teacher in my ward for like 3 years, and I was really good at it.
That always seemed like the worst calling to me.
I know. Well, you know, my wife would agree with you. Most people would agree with you. But for me, I loved it because I love teaching, and I felt really good when I did it. I was able to, you know, during this time I was starting to, you know, I would have these doubts, but it's like that time during gospel doctrine, I was able to set all that stuff just completely aside because I know all the words, right? I know the doctrine. I know all the things, right? And I'm able to present it in a way that's, you know, it isn't boring. And so it was fun for me and it was fun for the class. I would always get compliments on, you know, my gospel doctrine teaching, you know, and I loved it and it was great. And at one point and this was before I was kind of teetering on the edge. I was standing in front of the class and I told everybody, it's like, you know, I'm having a hard time believing in these things.
Wow.
You know, in front of my, and the fascinating thing about it was everybody was super supportive. You know, people come up later and say, that was great. You know, we think you're great. And so from then on, you know, I was able to, you know, I would teach the class and I would teach everything. I would never teach anything that was, you know, like, you know, Joseph Smith wives or, you know, all any kind of quote unquote anti-Mormon stuff.
You stuck to the manual.
I stuck to the manual. Yeah. I was uniquely gifted in reading the manual and making that entertaining, which is not a very helpful skill if you're not teaching gospel doctrine anymore. But I would bring things up about the fact that, but I'm still having a hard time believing it. Everybody was really supportive. And I was finally released from that calling for, you know, whatever reason. It wasn't because of in my belief because it was still going pretty well. It was just one of those things. And then after that, I really didn't have any strong, because that was my connection to wanting to actually go, right? Because I never really enjoyed sacrament meeting because it always stressed me out because I was afraid somebody was going to say something embarrassing. And so I would be so embarrassed for them.
Fast and testimony meeting must have been awful. Yeah,
seriously, it's so hard. And it would just, luckily the ward we're in now, actually, we don't actually have any of those kind of crazy guys that go up there and say that everybody's actually pretty good about just saying normal, boring testimonies, which is great for me. Even though they're boring, at least they're not stressing me out. But, you know, after that, I went into the bishop and I started telling him about my doubts.
Were these specific? Like, had you read history or anything, or is it just a general doubt?
It was, I started reading things. Like, I found MormonThink.com and I started reading the stuff on there, but the main thing had always been in my mind that it's all internal to my brain. All of the feelings that I have that this is true, it's all inside my head. And I know for a fact for many years that my brain can tell me things that are not true.
Because, just like your panic attacks.
Exactly. Because my brain is telling me I'm getting attacked by a bear right now. And I'm obviously not, but my brain sure is making my body think it is. And my heart's going 100 miles an hour. And my brain is telling me that I'm having a heart attack right now when I wake up in the middle of the night. And I'm obviously not. And so it is really easy. It is easy to make people feel things. And, you know, just go to a concert. You feel really excited and great, and you just feel these emotions that just flow through you, or listen to a good speaker, or ride your bike down a really steep hill. You know, you get these really strong emotional reactions, and that isn't any different to feeling the Spirit, or what everybody had ever said was feeling the Spirit, or how I had ever felt the Spirit. And that fact was the thing that stopped, that I couldn't believe because of that. And so I would tell the bishop that. And, you know, I had these other things that I had learned, but those were secondary to the fact that I really just didn't think God was there. And there was no way to show that he was there because he doesn't actually talk to anybody. And so, but my bishop, you know, he was great. He's a good guy. And he was working with me and everything was fine until one day I was at work and I think I'd been thinking about it a lot, and I was texting with my wife and actually chatting with her on the computer. And I told her that I don't believe. She knew I'd been having doubts, but
told her through text.
I told her. I know. Well, see, okay. So they tell you what you don't do is you don't take them to your favorite restaurant tell them that way. So I went the complete opposite way and I did it over text. Yes, I'm a terrible person. We can all agree on that. But yeah, it was funny. I wasn't planning on doing it that way, but I think we had just started talking about it. And I finally just said, you know, I don't believe anymore. And just saying that, I felt so much better. Like immediately, I felt so much better. And I made the mistake of telling her that I just felt better now. I felt good. And
how did she take it?
Not great at all. It infuriated her. And she was so angry because in her mind, you know, I basically just given up. You know, I wasn't trying anymore. And she plays in the Utah Valley Orchestra. And I don't know if it was that night I think it was actually that night she had to go and, to practice. And she was driving, so I was home with the kids. And she called me on the phone, and she was she was so upset. I was afraid she was going to get in a wreck because she was driving, and she was just yelling about how angry she was that, you know, sarcastically telling, just like, I'm so happy that you're happy that you don't believe anymore. And I take all of that on myself, right? It's like I've always done in my life. It's like, it's my fault that my wife, who I love dearly, is feeling this pain right now. This is my fault. And so I feel really bad because I'm making her feel so bad. And that's hard because I want, you know, I want to be authentic and I want to be able to find a way to be able to navigate life in a way that makes sense to me. I don't want to hurt her and I don't want to hurt any of my family. And so she made it home safe after that. I was thinking she didn't get in a wreck, but we had a lot of discussions after that. And, you know, they were really heated for a while. So, you know, we had to be careful not to talk about it sometimes for a while because it was just because we're both completely convinced that we're right, as everybody is. You know, everybody knows that they're right. And so for a while, it was really hard to have a discussion about it without it immediately escalating into like yelling. The crazy thing is that my wife, she is smarter than I am, like objectively. And so I can't say, well, she just doesn't know, or she doesn't know. She is able to, she's just an innately believing person. And she is able to read, you know, I show her a video on the Book of Abraham on YouTube, or really wouldn't, when it just goes through exactly, it's just like, well, obviously this is dumb. And, I show it to her and it just doesn't phase her. Or we talk about like Noah, you know, in the ark, and she just, it's not that she doesn't care, but she takes what she needs out of that story. And for her, it's just, it doesn't matter. Like the technical details of how you feed millions of animals for a year, those details don't matter. It's what the story means and the fact that we'll find out all about it someday. Someday we'll know all the answers. And so she doesn't understand why I don't see it that way, and I don't understand how she sees it that way. And so it can be a kind of an impasse sometimes. So my wife found out about it, and then, and I wish I could remember, but my parents then found out. I am an atheist, and they found out about it. My mom really didn't take it very well at all. And
I always feel bad for the moms.
I know, right? Me too. Because she's just like, because for her, would it be wrong for me to read a text that she sent?
No, go ahead. It's your story.
Yeah. So my mom, shortly after.
First say, I love you, Mom.
Yeah. Mom, I do love you. I really do. So this is what she wrote shortly after she found out about it. She says, "Oh, Jer, I know you're a great person. I know this is not you. I am worried you are throwing away blessings and your salvation. You have accepted and believe a lie. It will make it harder for you to come back because those bad spirits are around you. What are you reading? What about your family? Angie may leave you. You risk everything. I love you. I always love you. Light always overpowers dark. It is up to you. This is your test. We are all tested. Please, if not for yourself now, for your family." And later on, she sent another one. "My dear Jer, I know you were mad at me, and for your pain, I am so sorry. I see the danger coming, and I feel desperate on your behalf. I am very sorry, and I pray every day for you and your family. This is what it means that men's hearts will fail them. I hurt with you, and I will never give up on you. I pray you never give up on yourself. I can see pain in Angie's eyes, and I am terrified. It came out Sunday. I love you very much." And so on.
That's hard. You can hear her anguish, but you know you're not surrounded by evil spirits. And yeah. You don't want her to have her think of you that way.
No, I don't. And I don't, because, well, she says very explicitly there several times that this is, men's hearts fail them. So my heart failed me. I just didn't, you know, I didn't endure to the end. And you know, and I'm currently not enduring to the end right now. And it makes me sad because I am legitimately, despite all, I will say that I am, except for the interpersonal conflicts that I have with people that are upset with my, you know, with the fact that I'm an atheist, I am so much happier now than I ever was with, you know, as believing, because death doesn't, it doesn't scare me like it did, which is weird because, you know, for me, I'm just, it is going to be exactly the same as it was before I was born. You know, I don't remember that. You know, when I'm asleep at night, it'll be like that, except for just a non-dreaming sleep. And it's just going to be like that, except for forever. But what that means is that I really need to make sure that this life is, it's the only one I got. And, you know, I have to help other people. If I see pain, no, I have to step in and try to alleviate it any way that I can. And if I see injustice, I have to do something about it. I mean, I'm nowhere near good enough at doing that as I wish I was, but that's just the old Jeremy being hard on himself. You know, I still, thankfully I am now and have been for quite some time now seeing a counselor who is wonderful. She is very great and is wonderful at actually walking me through these kind of hard times I've had with, you know, with my family, with my wife. And but it helps me be able to recognize between the difference between feeling guilt, you know, and beating up on myself. I'm able to recognize when I start doing that and then kind of put a stop to it and try to live a better life. But it can be hard
sometimes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
How does it stand with your wife now?
It is actually much better now. A few weeks ago, you know, I had been still going to sacrament meeting with her, and then I would just kind of walk home after we live close enough to the church that I can just walk home afterwards. And, you know, every time after sacrament meeting, I'd give her a hug and say goodbye, and I saw a little bit of pain on her face because I wasn't staying. And I was finally just, I wasn't able to do it anymore. And so I can't go to church anymore. It's not doing anything for me. And in fact, it's making it worse because it can make me angry. It's at the very best, it's boring. At the worst, it makes me angry. And so it's not doing any good. And so I haven't been going the last few weeks, and we still read the Book of Mormon together every night, 5 verses. Each of us takes a turn, and I'm fine with that. It's fine. Although it's funny because going back through reading the Book of Mormon again, it's just so silly. It's so racist, and it's just so boring. And my goodness. But, you know, we're like an Alma now, and it's just objectively dumb. Well, I can't say objectively. It is subjectively dumb. And, but, you know, so I don't really worry about my boys. I have 3 boys.
And how old are they?
So 13. 10? 9?
I sure hope you got that right.
Yeah. No. Well, my oldest is 13 and I forget. 9, 10. I think he's 10 now. And 7. So my oldest boy has always been very, very smart. He knows that I'm an atheist, but doesn't seem to bother him. My kids are interesting because all 3 of them are on the autism spectrum. My youngest has it the worst. He's almost 8 now, and he doesn't he talks, but he has a hard time communicating. And my oldest boy, he's more of a Asperger's syndrome thing, so he has a hard time communicating, although he's super smart. And so if it bothers him, doesn't really say that it bothers him, but he knows he has to go to church still. And I'm glad he does, because he doesn't get a lot of social interaction otherwise. But, and my younger two just, they don't notice either way. So, yeah.
And how is it with your mom and dad? Have they come to feel any better about the situation?
We don't really talk about it anymore.
Okay.
We've had some discussions, because my entire family and my wife's entire family, they're all active believing members. Mostly. There's like one or two caveats, but I'm not going to say who. But, so they don't really get where I'm coming from. And we've had a couple of discussions about it, but after that, it's just, we just don't talk about it. So it's there, but, and that's fine with me, you know. I would like everybody to agree with me, but I've finally gotten over the hump where I feel like I have to constantly, like, it's just like it's a thing that I have to constantly talk about. Even though I guess I liked talking about it if it's not going to turn into a fight, but you know, I don't have to convince my family. For, first of all, I don't think I could, even if I wanted to. And it's more pleasant if that's not part of the discussion, because it gets ugly pretty quick if you do talk about it. But if we don't, then everything's great. Yeah. And so there was, for each person that found out that was close to me, there was an immediate argument and fight and people and hurt feelings. And it was traumatic, but then it kind of got better over time.
They had to sit with the panic.
Exactly. Yeah, they did. And so I've gone through, I think, most of the close relationships in my life, and either people I work with are either already atheist, or we just don't ever talk about it, or they're believing and they don't care either way. And which is, I prefer it, actually. One of my better friends, he's a believing member, but he doesn't bother him at all that I'm an atheist. So, and I think that's great, because then we don't have to worry about it. You know, we could just talk about stuff and it's fine. So, but yeah, so it's those relationships, it's the initial shock that's the worst. But then when you still have to either live together or live with your family, it slowly, at least it seems to slowly kind of mend itself over time. I found the thing that was really helpful for me was recognizing when things were going to start getting heated, and to just kind of back off a little bit, and then it immediately cools off. Because I found that, even though this feels like, especially in my marriage, that it's not, before I suddenly had trouble believing, we didn't really ever talk about church, like at all, except for when we were at church or go to general conference or whatever. But the rest of the time is just talk about whatever else is going on.
I don't think that's uncommon either.
Yeah. And so it feels weird that we should be able to just slot right back into that, even though we both have these, you know, there's a Sunday thing where she goes, does her thing and I don't. And the rest of the time it should be fine. It's not, because for her specifically, it's like I've kind of ruined her eternal family thing here, unless I come back sometime. And so that's a thing that's constantly hovering over her. It's not, I will freely admit, it is not as hard for me, because it doesn't really, I understand why she believes, and it doesn't really bother me that she believes. But it really bothers her that I don't, because it has eternal consequences if I don't. But she has recognized herself as well that it's not all me. And, you know, like any marriage, there's two people, and you gotta be able to work through it together. And so she's actually been trying really hard as well to make things better. And it has been better now, especially last little while has been much better.
Do you think she ever considered divorce?
Yes. Yes. In fact, it's so funny. There's a weird time compression thing that happens when there's like a lot of traumatic things happening. It feels like things happened a long time ago, but they weren't really that long ago. but we had a discussion. We were mad about something and we were just fighting. And then we said, well, maybe we should just separate for a while. And I really thought about it, you know, and we were kind of angrily texting at each other. And I was like, fine, I guess I'll see you when I see you. And I'll
go. You need to stop texting.
I know, right? But this, for whatever reason, this seems to happen the worst. It seems to happen when I'm like either at work or elsewhere. But yeah, it wouldn't be any, that's the thing, it wouldn't be any better if we were talking. But then I thought about it. I was just like, I'm being stubborn for no good reason. And so we were able to calm that down and we were able to talk it through and things are better though. But I would have never thought that that would have been a thing that would happen because we'd just been happy together for, I mean, we've been married almost, I mean, was it 16 years now? Been married 16 years and, you know, for most of that, just happy until this came along and I ruined everything. So I can see why that might cause some angst for her because things were good and now they're harder than they were before. Although they are getting better.
Yeah. Again, you have to sit through that panic.
Yeah.
It works for everyone, doesn't it?
Right. You have to be able to sit with it and not avoid it and talk about it. The thing that really helps is the fact that I just love her to death and she is my favorite person in the world. And so even when she infuriates me, and doesn't see things that doesn't agree with me. I mean, can you imagine the gall of somebody not agreeing with me? Even when that happens, you know, I can at least remember, you know, that I love her and, you know, and she remembers that she loves me. And so we're able to struggle past the things and you start to find a new equilibrium and you have to start to find really when you don't have the church there that's taking up all this mental space, you have to find other things that you're basing. Cause, you know, the church was like this thing that we're always doing. And so you kind of rip that out, at least for rip out one of the stool legs when I go. And so it's all wobbly. So you have to prop that up somehow with something else. And so we're negotiating that still. And it is better. It's hard. My goodness. Faith transition. What the heck?
Yeah. It's really hard.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like you've come to a comfortable working it out kind of place right now.
Yeah. I am. It would be wonderful if there were a definitive happy ending. And there is, I will say that I am happy today. And I was happy yesterday and I think I'm going to be happy tomorrow. I don't know. Tomorrow hasn't come yet. So I might not be, but day by day, I am happy to be alive and I'm happy to be married to my wife and I'm happy for my wonderful boys. And these struggles have been struggles and but you know, I kind of made it through, which is crazy because at the time it sure didn't feel like it, both with the anxiety. I didn't think that I would ever make it through. And with, you know, the faith transition, it didn't feel like it was ever going to get better. It was just always going to be just this constant gaping wound forever, but it's not. It's weird.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate you coming and sharing your story.
It has been fun.
I think it'll help a lot of people. It's helped me just sitting here with you. So that's all worth it then if you help me.
Absolutely. If I could help you, Katrine, that is all.
And we all know I need it.
Absolutely.
Thank you again for listening to Mormon Expression Voices. If you want to be part of our podcast, you can email me at voices@mormonexpression.com. And we can also do Skype interviews as well now. So if you're far away and you want to Skype, send me an email. All right. Everyone have a good night. Bye.